You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 403 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I apologize in advance for my voice. It's a bit croaky. I've been on antibiotics for the last few days due to a throat infection. Yeah, you know, brought back from nursery school by my youngest son. Of course, they spend their times in these viral soups that are nursery school, and of course, my older one at primary school. But so be it. This is the way it is. Thank you again to those of you who have signed up on Patreon.com at patreon.com/Columbia Calling, where you can make contributions to the Columbia Calling podcast and ensure that we, you know, we're economically viable to continue making the podcast. That's myself and Emily Hart on news. We've also set up another page where you can make one-off donations, so therefore you don't have to do the Patreon thing. It's kind of like buymeacoffee.com, the American one, but this one's called Coffee, but it's ko-fi.com. So it's ko-fi.com, Columbia Calling. And you can make one-time donations for as little as $5. Just throw a little something at us to help us out. This week's podcast is quite special to me because part of the idea of the Columbia Calling podcast was always to reveal unknown or lesser known stories about Columbia. And thus we've really excelled in this one today because through finding a guy on Twitter who put a thread out about these sort of revolutionary missionaries in the Sierra Nevada, so up near the Caribbean coast. Well, we got to talking, it's Juan Sebastian, and we got to talking about a documentary that this team, a young team, have put together, and they're in post-production right now, and it's a documentary called Las Señoritas, and it details the female single missionaries, largely from Medellin, who head up into the Sierra Nevada with the Arawako people or the Kogi people. And it's not about trying to pull the poor indigenous person out of poverty and out of ignorance, as you would find so much in other stories of missionaries, or exactly like the Capuchin missionaries who try to convert people up there in the Sierra Nevada. This is about going up there and finding God within the actual beliefs and cultures of the existing people up there. So from the Catholic Church, this is incredibly revolutionary. And, you know, people don't know about this organization, I don't even know what to call it, but it's USEMI, USEMI. That's how we'll refer to it. And we're going to talk to Daniela Rocha and Daniel Velasquez, who are part of the team, and they'll be telling us about their experiences filming in the Sierra Nevada, what this documentary means, and of course, how long this project took place. And of course, I think it was the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. And these women who went up there had quite a profound impact, not only on themselves, but also on the area in which they were working. But you know, you approach this with a certain degree of skepticism because, of course, the word missionary doesn't really engender hugely positive connotations today. But hearing about this documentary and what these guys have put together changes one's outlook, and it's very much an anthropological study, and very much, it's not from an outsider's view. I think that the Mamos and the Kogi people are very much the centerpiece of this, alongside the Usemi missionaries. So I hope I've explained it a little bit, But at the same time, you're going to have to listen to understand. And I will be posting, of course, on our Facebook page and on Twitter, the links to their teaser clip, and indeed where you can contribute to help this team get Las Señoritas through post-production this next year. So that's me. I'm going to give you pass you over to Emily Hart now with the news, and then we'll be back in segment three with Las Señoritas, well, the documentary, and two members of the team talking to us about their experiences and what this means. Thank you again for listening, and bye-bye.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your top stories from Colombia for the week of November 22nd, 2021. A scandal of international scope for Colombia's police force this week, as policemen were caught in costume as Nazis, with uniforms, swastikas, and a replica Luftwaffe plane. One officer was even in costume as Adolf Hitler. Held at a police school in Tuluá, in Valle del Cauca, the event was supposedly part of Internationalization Week. The scandal broke as the academy themselves posted photos on social media. The German and Israeli embassies in Bogotá expressed total rejection of the event, while the US ambassador branded it outrageous and offensive to all victims of the Nazi regime. President Iván Duque condemned the event, and the public prosecutor's office has now opened a preliminary inquiry into the use of Nazi symbols. The president has announced that Colombia's economy is on track to grow more than 9% this year. The government statistics agency said this week the economy expanded 13% in the third quarter compared to the same period last year. Meanwhile, the World Bank is to loan $500 million to Colombia to support social and economic integration of Venezuelan migrants into the country. It's the first ever loan given by the World Bank exclusively focused on cross-border migration. The loan will finance the regularization of 1.7 million Venezuelans currently under temporary protection status, and the integration of more than 700,000 people into the social security system, as well as the improvement of housing conditions and coronavirus vaccinations for more than 1 million Venezuelans. And reproductive rights have been waylaid again in Colombia. This week, the Constitutional Court was supposed to begin discussing the decriminalization of abortion, with a deadline to decide on Friday. But the process has been delayed by a legal challenge over one of the judges' competence to take part in the decision. Justice Alejandro Linares gave an interview in Semana magazine, in which he referred in passing to the abortion debate. Days later, a claim was lodged of his impediment to partake, due to having supposedly revealed his vote. It was, however, already known that Linares was in favour of decriminalisation from his voting history. In his written statement, he maintains that there is no reason to remove him because he did not express his opinion to the magazine. But, instead of debating the issue itself, the court debated and voted on the impediment, and the vote was tied. This means a further delay, as another judge will now have to decide. If Linares is declared unable to rule on the case, a new judge will be appointed, causing more delays. Never before has Colombia been so close to making reproductive rights a reality. Though currently every year 400 women are criminalised for having an abortion, the huge majority of those prosecutions are of women in rural areas. New figures show that 40 members of the trans community have died this year in violent acts related to murders and deaths resulting from human rights violations. Compared to 2020, this year has seen a 25% increase in rights violations and homicides. Colombia is thus the second most dangerous country for trans people in South America, after Brazil, according to the Transaction and Support Group Foundation. Former heads of the Cali cartel, the Rodriguez Orejuela brothers, have agreed to testify at the Truth Commission. They're expected to speak about their claims that they financed the political campaigns of two former presidents, Andrés Pastrana and Ernest Samper, both with full knowledge. Gilberto and Miguel Rodriguez Orejuela have been in prison in the USA for more than 15 years, having been extradited and convicted of drug trafficking there, now serving sentences of 30 years. Following a slight climb, coronavirus cases in Colombia have levelled out again, now at around 2,500 new daily cases. Nearly 70% of the country have now had one dose of vaccine, 46% are fully vaccinated. Those were your top stories from Colombia for the week. I'll be back next Monday.
And we're back. This is episode 403 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia. My very able apologies to all of you for my voice. I've got a little bit of a frog in my throat, but you can comment on that later. This episode is quite special because it came about because I saw like a 40-something long Twitter thread, and it was to deal, it dealt with a documentary, and it dealt with the Sierra Nevada, you know, up beyond Santa Marta, and of course the indigenous peoples that are there located. So I got in touch with the guy, Juan Sebastian, who put this together, and we started talking, and it's, well, yes, he and a team have been putting together this documentary, and well, they're coming to the end of, the documentary now, making it. And so we've got this opportunity today to speak to Daniela Rocha, who's a producer, originally a psychologist, but she's the producer of the documentary. And we've got Daniel Velasquez, who is an editor, and he's also a filmmaker, having studied here in Bogota and in Havana, Cuba. So we're going to discuss a little bit about this documentary because it comes in from a different angle, really, when we talk about filming in the Sierra Nevada mountains behind Santa Marta, and of course the importance of a story surrounding religion, the indigenous people, their findings, what it was like to film up there, and so on. But I'm going to stop talking and say, Daniel and Daniela, welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Thank you very much, Richard. Hello, everyone that's listening. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak about our documentary and about this project that is very exciting for us.
Hi, everyone. I'm Daniela. Thank you, Richard, for this opportunity too. I think that these opportunities are one in a million, like being able to talk about a little project that is going to be really big and we didn't understand how this happened.
That's a really nice way of starting. Well, first of all, the flattery is wonderful. This is certainly not one in a million. I'm just a guy with a microphone here. But this documentary, Las Señoritas, obviously the two of you have been, and with a big team, have been living and breathing this documentary. Perhaps, I don't know, which one of you would like to start and give us a summary of what the documentary is about?
This documentary film, it's about the history about Las Señoritas. There were a group of women and men, but mostly women, that lived in the Sierra Nevada, Santa Marta, in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s. They were working for the church then, but they were creating new forms of teaching the indigenous, the Arhuaco people, to maintain their culture and not being taking Catholicism and Christianism over their culture, but making them learn their own culture as well. This group of people is called USEMI, Unión de Seglares Misioneras. And this documentary, it's really interesting in the context of Colombia because, you know, Colombia has had a lot of violence in history, a lot of black and white thoughts. It's like this or it's like that. And these sort of stories, let us know about all these really gray shades of things that are between all the political things that are going on in Colombia around that time. And that makes it really important nowadays because we're living in a society that's quite divided between left-winged or right-winged political thinkings. we have been working in this project around like more than a year and a half, I think. We're working with other two guys, Juan Sebastián Zapata and Santiago Usán. They are both co-directing this project. They were actually the ones that went to the Sierra Nevada and they filmed there. I have not been there, but they have related all their stories and they have talked to us a lot about their experience. I think Daniela was there too at some point. I'm not really the guy to talk about how was the process filming there, but I can share some of the experience that they have told me and a lot of the points of view that are like around the documentary, indigenous, these las señoritas, and also different parts of the story that have been taken a point of view in the story. So, yeah.
This story, USAMI, the organization that's up there. This is a from the United States?
No, they were founded by a guy that is called Monsignor Valencia Cano. He was known like the, wait a second, I'm going to search a word. he's called the the Red Bishop of Colombia.
Okay.
And he's part of the history of Colombia as a revolutionary part of the church, of the Catholic Church, because he was trying to make evangelization and missions a work that was with community and based on the poverty, but not as based on the brainwash work that had been made in other works of the church. So he started training them, USAMI, that is a group of girls from Medellin that were trying to search like a new way of working with people. They were not identified with the traditional main roles of the woman. They were not whores, they were not religious, but they were not also a woman that wanted to be married with someone. They were like free women and they wanted to work with people. So they get to know the bishop, the Red Bishop, and he start training them to work with society, to work with people. So they start working with him in Buenaventura. They also worked in Chiapas in Mexico. And then they start working in La Sierra. In La Sierra, they start with an education program that was based in the culture of indigenous people, not in the religion or in the Catholic thoughts. And they start traducing things and start to, how do you say that, like writing the indigenous language. After, they start to work with political issues that they were fighting, like their territory, their education, their language. And they were like a little piedra en el zapato.
They were a stone in the shoe.
Yes, they were the stone in the shoe from the church, because they were really different of every mission in La Sierra, and they were making like all the things that they didn't want, like La Iglesia didn't want them to make. They were changing society. So that's why we find it like really interesting. They were Colombian, but they were making a work that was never seen in Colombia. Mm-hmm.
This is truly fascinating. I'm starting from the beginning here, and I'm learning now from you. But this, you know, head bishop, as you say, this is truly revolutionary, as you again, that it's a definite break from what we expect the Catholic Church to be doing. You know, we go all the way back to 1492, and you know, the Catholic Church doesn't have the best reputation in this part of the world. Let's say there is I think the lightest way of putting it is it's just a slant on absolute cruelty towards native populations. And then you've got these usemi, these ladies, as you say, las señoritas, who don't want to be married and don't want to have children, but they do want to participate making a change. I mean, these sound like early feminists. They sound like people who are very strong. And so I need to start with the kind of question here is, and I don't know which one of you can answer it, is like, why did the bishop choose, or why did they choose La Sierra and La Sierra Nevada and this area to go? And what I like, what you are explaining to me is that this group went there, and it wasn't to try and, let's say, pull, and I'm putting this as a sort of a quotation, pull the poor indigenous people out of poverty and their undeveloped lifestyles. It was to find, I can see this as finding a common ground for religion amongst and within their culture. I don't know. Do you guys want to make a comment on this?
Yes. Like, there's a really interesting part in your question that is like, why Usemi did arrive to La Sierra. A great part of north of Colombia was dominated by a mission that was called La Misión Capuchina. They were a mission that is really traditional, like even medieval, maybe. Like, they were trying always to punish people because of thinking in a different way. And they had a lot of people to evangelize. So they were not enough men for them. They start searching other missions and they arrived to Usemi. So they were called by their enemies. And they didn't know that Usemi was that revolutionary. So they called them, they thought there was like a little girly group of women that wanted to try to work with community, and that they were going to reproduce the same system. But there they had a really big surprise when they started, like, for example, prohibiting the indigenous people to read the Bible. Usemi didn't want the native people to change their culture. They wanted to understand the culture, so to search God in each people without modifying them. So it was a really different way of seeing religion. There is a thing that is called Concilio Vaticano II. I don't know how is it called.
Vatican something, rather. Conciliation.
Yes. That it was really a revolutionary way of changing of the main church of the Catholic religion that was made after Usemi started working. And in that council, they understood religion in a different way. They start saying, like, we have to respect people, we have to work with poor people. And Usemi, 20 years before, had already made the change. So they were like called by the bad guys. Then they made the revolution, and then they take out the bad guys of this area.
This is a really, really interesting because, you know, as you say, the Arawako people, and then there's different families within that, I guess the Tairona, the Kogi, and beyond, I guess the Kankwamo, because they're in the same area. And so
well.
On. So, I mean, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what it was like to go up, and maybe Danielle, you have some of the answers or the experiences, what it was like to go up there and meet with people and find people who remembered the Usemi group, maybe spending time with them. Because if they were there in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, it's, you know, I remember the 1980s, but you know, there aren't that many people up there in the mountains, I don't think, that remember all the way back.
Well, what my partners from the documentary have told me about this experience is that there's a lot of respect towards Usemi, and a lot of people remembers them, and they have it in a really good concept, in the concept that they were caring, they were really, really, really loving, they really managed to teach and to strength the culture around Arhuaco and Kogis. And well, most of them, of the Arhuaco people that talked about Usemi, always said something like, they were, my father knew them, you know, or my mother, like the generation before. So I think that's really important, because the reason why we got to this story was actually because people were talking about Usemi. Still nowadays, remembering them and their work there, it's tangible in the Sierra, in La Sierra. And I think that Usemi did a really, really important job. I think that probably things would not be the same if it was not for the work of Usemi. They actually, like Daniela said, they eventually took care of them towards the Capuchino missions that were actually destroying the culture. So, I mean, you can still, I think, I haven't gone there. I have not gone there to La Sierra, but I think that what I have been told is that it seems like a timeless place where culture stills there. You can perceive Arhuaco culture. It's a culture that's been preserved really well through time, decades, worth thinking. I mean, that's probably it. Daniela, you have maybe something to share about it.
Daniela, so your time when you went up into the Sierra, were you able to meet people who remembered the Usemi?
Well, when I went to the Sierra, I didn't know Usemi history, but I did live like the experience of being a woman in a society that is really different, and that does still think that women and men are really different. So getting up there first is really difficult, because the last main way to go up there is like, it can be like 1 day a walk to get to the main town. That have access to cars, so you have to walk a lot to arrive there, and there is no light there is no like water from like good water there. Everything is really different, and the way they used to interact with women is not that cool, because they start like searching men for talk. Maybe if you are trying to talk with them, they are going to ignore you because you are a woman. So that time I went there, I was thinking it's going to be really, really difficult to work with them, because I have to be really patient and have to be really comprehensive, not to take it personal. And then we found out Usemi history, and we start to understand that maybe being a woman and working in La Sierra is possible. So in that time, I didn't knew that indigenous people recognize Usemi, but I was able to understand the difficulties of being a woman there.
But as you said, I mean, you went there with a real, let's say, worry, and yet it was okay. I mean, it was challenging, but because of the arrival of Yusemi, things had been improved for you years before.
Well, mainly I think that it have improved for the people, because nowadays they have educational system based in their culture. They don't have the cappuccinos in the territory. They can have the limit, a clear limit between the resguardo, that is like the main territory that is protected for indigenous people, and other territories. And this in some way has been a possibility because of Yusemi. But of course, there's a lot of things that have to be improved. There is still a really big distance between the city life and La Sierra life, because they don't have access to, not all the towns have access to education, not all the people have access to health. They don't have access to the market. So if they need like rice, they have to walk like 3 days to buy it in the nearest place. It's not an easy life over there.
That's hard. I mean, that, obviously, but I mean, you get the feeling, and I've only been up there a couple of times, but not obviously as deep as you've gone into these places. But you know, these ancient families, they kind of just want to be left alone to live their lives, right? I mean, you correct me. I want to hear all of your experiences, because I mean, I've only been into the sort of low areas of the Sierra, and of course into, you know, way back in the day as a backpacker back in the around 2000 or 1999, I hiked the Lost City. So that's my only real knowledge, the Sierra Perdida. So maybe you guys could tell me just a little bit more about, I don't know, the reception, the culture, you know, how do they see you as well going up there to film? Because I'm sure they don't want to feel like, you know, they're in a fishbowl, you know, with everyone looking at them. It has to be something else, sure.
Yeah. I mean, they don't let anyone like film them or photograph them or go up there. I think that it's a process that can last years. And I think that for them, we're always going to be like city people, you know? But I think that their way of viewing life and understanding life can make them feel empathy towards certain people and feel their energy, feel their spirit. And they can, I think they make consensus. I mean, they talk within them, they take decisions in group. And I think that most of the times when my Santiago and Juan Sebastian were there filming, they were not allowed to film like whatever they wanted. They had to wait a little bit. So the Arhuaco people would deliver and will make a decision about what they can film, when they can film.
So Daniel, I mean, we were talking about, and you know, when we talk about Las Señoritas, and we were talking about how you have to behave really when you go up to this, it's a sacred area. You know, it belongs to other people despite being within the frontiers of Colombia. But it's sacred. It's something else, and you know, the indigenous people and the families up there, they have a different concept of time and the world, and their cosmovision on everything is different. So filming and being subject to budgets and time restraints and things like that has to be a real challenge. I mean, it, because you can't just go in and shove your camera at whatever interests you. There are serious rules.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to behave really with a lot of respect, with a lot of touch, really, really sensitive towards them, their culture. And I think that as a filmmaker, you have to be a lot very patient, very, very patient. I think that they can tell when you are like a guy looking for something, like a product, like somehow you want to go there, shoot, and then go to your house with beautiful pictures and great stuff, material, and like you don't care about them. I think that they can tell that. I think that the opportunity that they gave us to film there, to be with the community, was because they actually felt the good intentions that Santiago and Juan Sebastian had when they were filming. They are really sensitive guys. They have worked with indigenous communities before. Juan Sebastian has 6 years going off and on and off to the Sierra, and Santiago has worked with Temperas community. So I think that they have what it takes to make a connection towards Arhuaco and Cogis. So, I mean, I think that this is a challenge for filmmakers, but this is also a way of giving a shape to the film. Like, it's not like making other type of documentaries. This documentary, like it looks this way, it feels this way, it's been heard this way because of this type of rules that Arhuaco people has. This is a way like almost the Arhuaco people are directing the film, because they are the ones that in the end decide what you can shoot, where you can stand, what you can show. These kinds of challenges are the core of the film, are the heart of the film. And as you know, a lot of filmmakers in the past have said, Chris Marker, Werner Herzog, for example, that these sort of challenges are the ones that make you as a filmmaker get creative. Like really, you have to search for the image. You have to search for the time. You have to give it perfection to the shot. And it's not like you can shoot everything. It's not like you can like have hours and hours and hours and hours of shooting and of material. You have to be really selective. You have to have a keen eye, a keen ear. You have to listen a lot. And I think that this type of experience and the rules that Arhuaco people have there are something that are a great experience for a filmmaker, for an artist that's working there with them.
That Juan Sebastian has all of that experience coming up is just makes it all very different. So it makes a difference, and you know, there's a different type of sensibility towards filmmaking. And you, I mean, you spoke very much as someone, you know, who knows what he's doing. I think the challenges, and you said you quoted Herzog and everything else, but you spoke of Herzog and you spoke of others, and I can understand that. It's the challenges that you are presented with and how you let's say accommodate them makes something special. Now, I want to go back to the Sierra itself, and as I know now that Daniela was up in the Sierra, and you had your moments of when you were welcome and other moments when you were made to feel very aware that you were a woman up there, and you're searching for something. I bet you have some anecdotes about your experiences, some stories that you could possibly share with us, either happy ones or not so happy ones, or just ones that maybe we'd be interested in hearing, because it's so very different to anything that we really know.
Well, I have a lot of like moments that have been really significant for me in La Sierra. There is a family up there that is like our family, because they have been working with Juan Sebastian for more than 5 years, and they really care about him. So when he take people with him over there, they start to making us part of the family. And it's really, really special, because we can get to know really well the community, their practices, their way of living each day. And I remember that one day that it was really interesting, like living up there. That moment was the day that I have the menstruation. Yes. And I used the cup, like the menstrual cup. So I was cleaning it, and a girl was asking me, like, what is that? Why does you put that in your body? She didn't understand what I was doing. And I was trying to explain her that it was a way of protecting me from it. And she was really, really amazed because of that technology. And she told me that they only use like cotton, and that the relationship with that is really different, because they get closed like in quarantine for like 6 days each month, because they don't have the facilities for taking care of themselves those days. So it was one of the most weird things I lived up there. Maybe the most weird thing up there. I think that other great experiences up there is to play with the kids. The kids are really interested in the people that is not of their community, because all the Arawak people are in white clothes with their traditional way of dressing. And when you get up there with your like dresses, they look at you like, I don't understand, who is that person? Why does she wear that clothes? And they are really, the kids are really natural, approaching to us, asking us questions, taking like the camera, the cell phone, the books, like asking things. And one of them is a really beautiful girl. She's called Jinga, and she's really, really intelligent. And she's like 13 years old, but she have never been in school. But one day she asked me to teach her to write. And I only went there like 4 days, 8 days, I don't know, it was less than a week. And I was trying to teach her how to write, but I was thinking myself, like, she's going to be able to take the pen, but she's not going to be able to write. There's not enough time. But she was able to write her name, the name of his father and his brother, in a day. And I was like, really, it was not possible for me. Like, in the developmental time of kids, it takes a lot of time. And she was, I don't know, like really, really intelligent. And she's like a little sister for us, even though I have not been that much time with her. But she used to be like really close to us. And nowadays she wants to come to Bogota and like know the big city. So we are waiting for that moment to happen.
Quite a big change, quite a big step.
A really big change.
Do you think, and I just quickly, I mean, you've given me an idea, and I have children, and you know, my oldest son he knows how to write and read, and but he's six and has been through school and everything else, and it's a process. But do you think that she was so fast because of the lack of external distractions, you know, let's say TV, cell phones, that there's she could just channel all of her attention to the one thing with you? Have you ever thought that you might be exotic in this situation as well?
Of course, I'm exotic, super exotic for her, like a weird thing that move and she doesn't understand if I'm like a person or other thing, because she's really amazed with new things. But even though I think that it was part of the main reasons why she was like really paying me attention and not like playing with the cell phone or like in Instagram, because they don't have that. Maybe it's because she's really, really, really interested in education. And that's a little bit sad, because that's the main problem of their struggles, that even though they are protecting their land, they are living in a way that is between abandonment and the achievement of their struggles for territory, because they do want to have education, but an education that is made by them. So what happened is like, okay, we give the resources to some leaders that do not know how to use that resources, and you have to get up to make a school and be able to like create a pensum, and it's not that easy. So I think that in a way the struggles for territory here in Colombia are a good way of washing their hands of the government and saying, okay, I'm not invited there, so I'm not going to do anything more to help them to arrive to a good education. So she had to, she had to take advantage of that moment as a unique moment in her life. And that's kind of sad, I think.
It's a fascinating, this concept of being, okay, so yeah, there's money for the schools, you've got to build your own school. And I can just imagine the government saying, oh, this is what we do for grades 1 to 5, and just saying, this is what you have to learn. But let's move on, and we start closing this down. But Daniel, we mentioned before that the USEMI, and these are the key, one of the key things, they were present in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and then it ended after the 1980s. There was no more USEMI projects in the Sierra.
After that, what happened was that somehow the indigenous people. After all these years of teaching by USEMI, Arhuaco people decided that it was now time for them to be by themselves. It's not like I'm not actually really sure of the details, but the way I see it, it's like USEMI taught so much to Arhuaco people that the ultimate teaching was be alone. You don't need us. You know, like, I think that actually USEMI did understand the situation and they went away from there. But what I also think happened was that near the early 80s in the Sierra, there was a conflict going on there, guerrillas. And this kind of stuff was really, really something really important there. And I think that it's something that affected a lot to the USEMI missions around there. I think that the context was not the best for USEMI to keep on developing their work. But I think that that's what happened, actually. I mean,
It might be that they, you know, came to the end of their cycle, and if you know, a revolutionary Catholic entity sees the end and can go, it's an amazing feat. You know, you expect, because you sort of imagine them as missionaries, but they're very different. This is not a missionary, as you know, like the film from the 1980s, The Mission and things like that. This is not. So the two sides coming together, obviously the conflict, we know the Sierra has been and in various parts continues to be very affected by the conflict and so on. And then, of course, the end of the USEMI kind of project, finding its end, having taught the people. And now the people themselves can take the project forward, which is, of course, is a success story for any project. You know, it's not a cycle of always waiting for the next do-gooder to come along, you know?
Yeah, well, I think it was a complex phenomenon, what happened there. I mean, I wouldn't say that it was just like USEMI find the end of the cycle. I think that a lot of things happened towards the end of USEMI there. There's some things that happened around there. There was somehow, like, there was a plane that crashed and some of the USEMI girls died there. They didn't know if it was sabotage or somehow. I think that not all the Arhuaco people agreed on USEMI being there. We have to understand that this community, very organic, has a lot of points of view as well. There is a lot of, Arhuaco people are as any people. If you have 10 people, maybe 5 think one thing, 2 other think another thing, 3 think another thing. So I think that the USEMI phenomenon was, at the end of the cycle, converging into a lot of points of view, complexity. Maybe it was not like black and white, it was really gray. So I think that part of the challenges of this documentary is exploring and trying to figure out what actually could have happened at the end of the cycle, trying to explain and to show this phenomenon that was really complex. So your question is actually a question that the film is trying to solve. And it doesn't have a simple answer. I think that it takes analysis, investigation, and a lot of thinking about it, because there's a lot of things going on there, I think.
What Daniel says is true, like to the extent that they work so that the indigenous people could continue with their project. So they thought them to be teachers, nurses, and even how to pull teeth, because they had no people to make their teeth held. So they helped them to be like autonomous. But when at the end of their work in La Sierra, they helped them to remove the Capuchin missionaries of the territory. To the extent that the indigenous people who were more traditional fought with them for the departure of the Capuchins. But those who had already been evangelized said that if one mission have to go, then they have to leave everyone, like USEMI and the Capuchinos and everyone, in a way that they were forced to leave. But one of them stayed there living until she died. And she was even buried as a mamu, that is like the great spiritual leader of the community, because she was really important for them and she was really respectful with them. She was like, she was the one that all USEMI thing was too much traditional for being true, because everything that a leader said, she obeyed, no matter what was that. So she had a really good knowledge of the community and of the cosmovision of Arhuaco people and Kogi people, in a way that she arrived to be like a leader for the native community.
That's that's no small feat. I mean, that's an incredible opportunity and an incredible high praise for someone to be accepted totally and therefore an, you know, exalted in a community such as that. I think, unfortunately, I mean, we could talk forever, but we don't have enough time, unfortunately. But I have to ask you both, when will we be able to see Las Señoritas? And is there a website that we can check out and stay informed?
Yes, we think that, well, the documentary is going to be even more fast if people help us. But the main plan, I think, is to have it at 2023. And we hope that this year we're going to finish the post-production. We have our main account on Instagram, that is Las Señoritas Documental. I'll write it in the chat after. And also we have a crowdfunding page that is in Baki, Colombia. So if you want to help us, you have to go to Baki and and just do your appreciation. I don't know how to say that.
Yeah, your donation.
Donation.
Well, listen, Daniel Velázquez and Daniela Rocha, thank you so much for your time and explaining a little bit about the complexities of Usemi and the Sierra and the time you spent and this... Obviously, this project that has consumed your lives for the most recent past. We will send people to check out your Instagram, Las Señoritas Documental. And I've got the link now for the VACI, which is the crowdfunding page. I'll put that up on our Facebook page and everything else. And we'll we will stay tuned for when the documentary comes out in 2023, because it will, because we have to be positive towards these things, you know. It will come out and you will have it on in, I don't know, some CineArte, and then Cine Colombia will come and take it, and then it will go to international festivals, and then, you know, big investors will give you lots of money for the next one. That's what it, you know, we want it to be positive, and we want this. So listen, thank you so much for your time, and I wish you all of you and the team and Juan Sebastian and everyone all the best in this next, and it's a tough period now, getting it finished and getting it out, right? So good luck with the rest, and thank you for being on the Columbia Calling podcast.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Throw it all over social media. So listen, thank you again. This has been episode 403 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I know you've enjoyed this episode, even with my children in the background. I guess it adds a little bit of ambience. But anyway, don't forget to tune in next week when we'll have more people talking something Columbia related.